I'm Kara Keehan, and this is Behind the Bench from AJP Hart and Cirque. Today, we turn the tables and interview the interviewers. Editor-in-Chief Irv Zucker joins us to talk with Lisandra De Castro-Brosh and Jonathan Kirk, our Behind the Bench podcast hosts. How did they get started in science? What's their best advice to trainees launching their own careers in physiology? And how did this whole Behind the Bench podcast come about in the first place? Let's dive in. Irv?
Thank you, Kara. Everybody has a backstory. Everybody has been influenced by many people in their life. And I want to thank Liz and Jonathan for engaging and for actually pioneering this Behind the Bench podcast series. I think it's been very useful for our trainees and for young investigators. The point of this podcast is to find out how people got started and what advice, what mistakes they made that would help other people. So Liz, could you start us off by telling us a little bit about how you got started in science and maybe who influenced you the most in your career choice?
Thank you, Irv, for interviewing us. So I started in science because my dad wanted me to go into math. I was very good at math, and math and biology were my favorite disciplines back in high school. So when I decided to go to university, it was really pushing me going towards math because it was like my highest grades. And I read about biotechnology. So I decided to go into an engineering biotechnology degree. So that was my first degree. And then we studied, you know, a lot of scientific stuff, a lot of engineering stuff. And I liked both, but I liked the molecular biology and science part way more. And then after my degree, that's where I decided to get my career into. So my first supervisor for my PhD, he was fantastic. He knew my background was more in engineering, and I did my PhD in a tissue engineering area, all in biomaterials. But he was the director of this institute where we did a lot of big surgeries, big animal surgeries for a variety of different companies and PIs from academia. And he allowed me to sit in all those surgeries and just chat with all the PIs and know about their science and what they were doing. And I thought, you know, I think I like biomedical sciences a lot. So I started moving my PhD more towards that. And then when I started being trained in postdocs, that's what I decided I wanted to do. So Paul Sibbons, my PhD supervisor, was a huge influence.
Yeah, that's a story that I think a lot of us can replicate. But I think it sounds like your father was a big influence on your choice of career. And that's really important. Jonathan, how about you? What got you started?
So I can sort of echo some of those similar themes of keeping an open mind and following what I enjoyed, but really people who inspired me. So I went to undergraduate at Washington State University with the plan of essentially going to medical school eventually, and picked a major I thought was kind of interesting, and that it would also make sure I got all of the prereqs. And sort of through the course of those 4 years, I ended up working with some people in their labs, Dr. Ken Campbell, Ken B. Campbell, not Ken S. Campbell, both are cardiac biophysicists, and then also David Lin, who worked in skeletal muscle. And during my time working in their labs, and then also in the courses, I discovered I really had a passion for research. And one of the things I got exposed to, one of the people I got exposed to was Sanjeev Shroff, who was a friend of Ken Campbell's. And he came and taught one of our classes as a guest, like they would come to visit each other. So he came from Pittsburgh to Pullman, and he guest taught one of our classes. And I was sitting in class, and it was a small class, like four or five of us. And I thought, I gotta work with this guy. So when I applied to University of Pittsburgh for their bioengineering program for the PhD, and I actually remember that I got a call from the chair of the department and said, you know, Pittsburgh's a long ways away. Why do you want to come all the way out here to our PhD program in bioengineering? You have a lot of great ones on the West Coast. And I told him, well, I want to work with Sanjeev Shroff. And the chair said, oh, gotcha. totally understand that. So I got in there and just really enjoyed it. And that kind of started off the whole thing.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. You know, one of the things that is very important in being successful, at least in biomedical science and the kind of work we do, is having strong mentors, both as an undergraduate in graduate school and during your postdocs. And I think mentors can really change your life. Could both of you comment on that part of the equation and how your mentors shaped your career path?
So I want to talk about good mentors and bad mentors, because I would say I had four major mentors throughout my training career. Three of them were fantastic. One, not so much. But I learned so much from that experience that really made me appreciate all the goodness that I got after that. And I think normally when we start talking about mentors, we really focus on the fantastic and good mentors we have. And they always made me think, oh my God, I hope someone is not listening that thinks, oh, I do not have that. Because I want them to know, you know, it happens to everyone. Sometimes we are all people, and sometimes you just don't get along with certain people. We all have different personalities, but you need to make the effort to learn as much as you can, even from that experience. And I would say keeping an open mind really pushed me to move past the first lab where I was and go and do my PhD. And then my second mentor during my first postdoc, Roberto Moterlini, he was also fantastic. He had a very different academic mind. He was interested in pushing boundaries and making sure we were moving our science into a translational science. And he had a lot of collaborations with companies. We were in this department that was called Drug Discovery and Development. And there was a lot of people from industry that we got to talk to. So that was really mind-blowing, because we disagreed on almost everything. But when we listened and sat down and had a good conversation, good things would come out of it. My third good mentor, my fourth mentor, it was a fantastic mentor. And I know I have a lot of similarities with Jonathan's story. So I'm pretty sure this name will come in his story as well, Dr. Mary Lindsay. I met her when I was doing my first postdoc with Dr. Moterlini in Italy. I went to this keystone about extracellular matrix, because even during my PhD, when I was doing biomaterials, that was always my passion, how matrix was remodeled. So I went to this ECM matrix, and that's where I met Mary. And we talked a little bit, and she was the one that introduced me to the word mentor, because I absolutely love both my PhD and first postdoc supervisors, but I always call them supervisors. They were definitely mentors, but for some reason, that was not a word we used to use. So Mary talked me about mentorship. And then when I went back, we were transitioning at that point, and Roberto was moving to Paris to start his lab there. And I really didn't want to go to another country where I had to learn the language again. It was starting to be a struggle since, you know, first was English and then was Italian. So I found a lab in Houston that was focused in extracellular matrix. And I sent an email to Mary. She was in San Antonio at the time. And I asked her, do you know this lab? Do you think it would be a good match for me? And she was, no. If you're coming to the United States, you're coming to my lab. And that's how I started my second postdoc with her, and was a fantastic experience. She's extremely supportive of her trainees. I learned so much. You know, the academia in Europe is quite different from in the US. So it was a ladder to climb to learn all the differences. And she was extremely supportive. So Irv, you're absolutely right. We are what the people behind us made us. And I wouldn't be where I am without all my mentors.
Yeah, we all stand on the shoulders of giants, for sure. It sounds like in your case, one sidelight of your career building was learning a bunch of languages, which is always a good idea. Jonathan, how about you in terms of mentorship?
Yeah, I only know two languages, English and bad English. So I'm very impressed by anybody who speaks, who can learn languages like that. So as immigration and science has been in the news recently because of some choices made at the top, I've seen a lot of people post on social media their labs with the immigrants removed. And my PhD mentor, Dr. Schroff, was an immigrant. And so I think, well, there would just be no picture at all, since without him, I wouldn't have been so interested in science. And I don't think I would have had the career that I've had. He was a great mentor, very intelligent, but also integrity was very important to him. And he also really cared for and was there for his family. And so that sort of work-life balance and showing how to have a successful career in science while still maintaining a strong family life was something I realized that I definitely wanted my mentors to have and to be able to teach me how to do that. And then, yeah, so as Liz said, Mary Lindsay comes into the picture. And I think one of the things that Liz said also is important here was that supervisors and mentors are not necessarily the same thing. All of your supervisors probably should be your mentors, but that you should have a lot more mentors than just those supervisors, and always be the lookout for people who are willing to give you a piece of themselves, sort of, because I always tell my students too that, you know, I'm going to do the best I can mentoring them, but they probably can't get everything they want from just me, and that they can be selfish. You know, when you're looking for mentorship, be selfish and go and look out and say, who do I want to be? And then I can go get mentors who can do the very best of each of those pieces. And I can like make a puzzle of the best people I know at each of these things. So, you know, Mary Lindsay came and gave a talk at University of Pittsburgh. And I didn't end up working for her, but she ended up introducing me to David Cass at Hopkins, who I did end up going and doing my postdoc with. And through that introduction, I had a great postdoc experience with David. And he, again, just a phenomenal scientist and mind, and mentored me, I thought, very well to be prepared for the challenges of academia. And then now, even as an assistant professor, I have a whole host of different mentors within the department and university and across the world.
Yeah, I think these are both great stories. I can add a little bit of my own background because it's very similar in some ways in terms of mentorship. And there's one important point I want to make here. And when I was a graduate student, my mentor was Gabor Cayley, who was was known for his work in the microcirculation. And although I was trained more as a renal physiologist in those days. And he had a philosophy. He was an immigrant also, came from Hungary post-World War II, and had a very European mentality. And in the first year of graduate school, he sent me to what was then called the FACIB meeting. And I said, Dr. Cayley, I really don't have anything to present. I was not far along with my research. He said, it doesn't matter. So you go to learn. You go to meet people. You go to build your career. And I think that's something that I've always remembered and used with my own trainees over the years, that if you have the money, if you can afford it, people go and you have to promote your trainees as best you can. And so I think that those are all good qualities of mentors. So Let me just move the subject on to a little bit of different topic. Sometimes there's a misconception in the general public that in order to be a scientist, especially a good scientist, one needs a superior intellect. Do you both agree with that, Liz?
Well, you definitely need to be sharp and intelligent, but there's so much more. You need to learn how to listen. You need to learn to be part of a team. You need to be resilient. I think that's like number one. You need to persist and be resilient because nothing comes easy. Your experiments never work the first time. And if they don't work, it doesn't mean because it did something wrong. It just might mean your hypothesis were wrong and you need to look at it in a different way. So you need to keep a very open mind and just challenge everything you see and you receive. So I don't think we all need to be genius. Some of us might be genius, but others might not be, but they're still extremely smart people.
Yeah. Jonathan, what about you? What do you think?
I think success in science comes in a lot of different flavors. Certainly, there are some brilliant scientists who can make amazing discoveries, but that doesn't mean that everyone who is a successful scientist is necessarily brilliant in that same sort of way. A lot of science is about communication, communicating your ideas and filtering out sort of the noise and listening to what's important. Even just writing grants and asking for money and fellowships, being able to communicate those ideas clearly is a really super valuable skill. And one of the things that I sometimes tell students is that honestly, in science, great ideas, like good ideas, they're kind of cheap. You know, there's a lot of good ideas floating around out there. And what's really important is being able to translate that good idea into actual science. And so that translation can look like hard work. It can look like determination and resilience. And that sort of opens up the ability for lots of people to find lots of different types of success in science. And I think we sometimes have a narrow-minded view of what success in science looks like. And also sort of even just the way that the science, academic science at least, is sort of set up, where there's really only a couple paths that are successful. And I think we ought to have more of those to celebrate the different people who have different skill sets.
Yeah, I think these are all very, very valid points. And let's not underestimate the importance of hard work in all of this. We all work very hard, and I think that can make up for a lot of things. So let's turn a little bit to something that Jonathan already alluded to, which is family work balance. Liz, how do you manage that? It's really difficult with a full-time academic position, getting grants written and papers written and doing experiments and bringing up a family. What's your secret?
I don't have one. I would say I'm not doing a fantastic job on that area. You know, you just have to make it work. For example, I didn't sleep last night because my child was having very high fever. So I am hidden in a corner of my bedroom while we're doing this podcast, but keeping an eye to make sure on the monitor if he starts crying because he's asleep right now. I would have to excuse myself and go check his fever. But I just do the best that I can. Family comes first. So, you know, he has a fever. I'm here for him. I told my chair that I wouldn't be at work today, and he's absolutely fine with that. Well, besides right now, we're still half working remotely. And when he's asleep, I go back to write my grant, and that's it. You just make it work. You need to have priorities, that's for sure.
Yeah, I feel like maybe you should interview my wife to answer this question. So much like a marriage, right? Work-life balance never means it's always 50-50. Right? It means there's a push and a pull and a give and a take. And obviously, sometimes in the lab, you just have to put in a ton of hours if you're going to be successful. And at that time, there's no balance. You know, it's all one direction. And other times, your kid is sick and you need to put everything else on hold. So, you know, it's really about being open to being able to do both of those things. And in order to have that and be able to go one direction and then the other direction, you need supportive people on both sides. Like Liz says, you need a chair who says, yes, of course, you stay home, take care of your kid. But you also need a family that is willing to say, you know, if you need to be in the lab or at the office 20 hours a day for the next week and in there for a couple weekends, that's fine as well. My wife was very interested in being a stay-at-home mom. She really wanted that. And so, you know, that in some ways made parts of my life easier. Of course, then we were a family on, you know, a single graduate student or postdoc stipend. And so with being stay-at-home orders and quarantine right now, getting home haircuts actually makes me feel very much like being a graduate student and postdoc again, and watching how your mentors do that and find that balance. And Liz, I'll just say, I think from everything that I know about you and have heard, I would say you're doing it very successfully. I don't think when you're doing it successfully, it feels like you're doing it successfully.
I agree. I think she was selling herself short there.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And I feel really bad after listening to Jonathan that I not said a heartfelt thank you to my husband, because of course I could not do this without him.
We all need supportive people in our lives, for sure.
I have one question for both of you, actually. We always speak about mentors, like the mentors that help us to get our career where we are. So normally it's like peer mentors or our supervisors. What about students? Have any of you had a student that you could also consider a mentor, that you learned so much from that one student that changed how you run your lab or your science?
That's a very good question, Liz. I always learn things from students. I think everybody's a little bit different, and everyone comes to the lab with different capabilities and ideas. And what I don't like is students that have no ideas and have no insight into what they're doing. But I have learned a lot of things from students, especially related to broadening our horizons and the way we think about specific questions in research. Some students that come from a bioengineering background may bring a different thought process to a problem. And I think we should be open and adopt those ideas, even though the person is very junior and comes from a slightly different background. Jonathan?
Learning from your students is something that a great mentor will do, because they're going to look at how each one of their mentees is an individual and they're different. And as you learn how to inspire and lead and teach people with different sort of personalities and how you make those personalities mesh with each other, that sort of helps me sort of learn how to be a better mentor. But even on top of that, if you create an environment where people are free to give you feedback, we ought to have annual evaluations where our trainees can evaluate us as well. Because you can start to get good ideas, and sometimes, you can have, as a PI, so many different things on your mind that certain things, important things, can sometimes fall through the cracks. And mm-hmm. having students there to remind you sometimes of the important things can really make you better and more thoughtful as a mentor.
Yes, I think those are great points. I want to just close with one other idea. It seems to me that some of the most successful people in whatever field one looks at are very broadly trained. If you look at Nobel Prize winners, for instance, across many different disciplines, you find out that they can do many things well. They can play an instrument, some of them paint. And there's a wonderful book by David Epstein called Range, which discusses this whole idea of being more broadly trained and getting inspiration and ideas from things that are not directly related to what you're doing. Sometimes we get ideas in the strangest places. Are either of you like that? Do you have other passions that bring you added value to your research careers? Liz?
I completely agree with what you just said, Irv. Even not just outside science, but within science, one of the things I'm always telling the graduate students is that what they're doing for a PhD, it doesn't mean it's going to be their career for the future. And many of them, that's what they think. So I'm always telling them, you just go and learn. Go to our colleague's laboratory and learn a new technique. You want to know as much as you can so you can approach a problem through different ways. Myself, if I have any other skills, I do like to paint and draw. I'm a very visual person, even if I'm in the lab and I have an idea, I need to put it on paper. So I always, just dribble all my thoughts on a paper. I'm very old school. I do a lot of paper and pen. It's because I do like to see it visually. It does help me a lot with my thought process.
How about you, Jonathan?
Yeah, I have a couple different outside interests, although I couldn't necessarily point to how they help me necessarily. So I am also a musician. I play the French horn, the most difficult of instruments. I think I feel pretty confident in calling it that. And so music has been part of my life since I was a kid. And I'm not sure it necessarily obviously helps me in any way, but there's definitely a sort of creativity to it. And I think there's been a lot of studies that have sort of indicated how a brain that approaches music, how it makes it sort of grow, become more complicated. I also was big into creative writing for a long time. I like writing plays and so forth. And so that certainly helped me sort of think about language as a dynamic thing, and how you communicate ideas and thoughts, complicated ideas and thoughts into sort of brief ways, almost like poetry. And I think that probably helps me in my general writing. I hope it does anyway. And I've also gotten into, over the past 5 or 6 years, into leatherworking, so making wallets and so forth. And I think that's just sort of, I like working with my hands. And so I definitely like putting together new rigs and so forth in the lab. And so making new things, new experimental rigs, is something that I really enjoy. So sort of combining that with an outside interest, I think has, you know, benefited both sides of that.
That's fantastic. So this has been a great discussion, and I think we'll end here, but I think it points out that successful people in general, and scientists in particular, come from a variety of different backgrounds and have a lot of different qualities, but there are definitely commonalities in how we get to where we want to go. And I hope this has been helpful to all of the young people and trainees listening in. Kara, we'll turn it back to you now.
I just wanted to say how much I really appreciate that you said yes, Liz and Jonathan, to being part of this project. And turns out that you're not only naturally talented at explaining things, you just have a warmth about you that's really lovely. And I wanted you to know how much I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Well, that was a little bit too
You're
much emotion
so
for me. So I'm going to deflect that emotion with a joke and say, it wasn't even really a harebrained scheme when you approached it to me. A harebrained scheme suggests an actual scheme. There was nothing True. Except for, hey, do you want to do something?
Right. I know. I was like, yeah, you're so right. We should collaborate in some way. I haven't quite worked it out yet, but I'll call
You're
you.
Like, maybe a podcast. I don't know. We'll see.
So true. I had it more fleshed out when I contacted Liz.
She had the plan by then.
I did.